Blog Talk Radio.
At Fringe, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well, also. And you know, you sound like your voice is just a little bit strained, Phil, but it's not because you're feeling bad, right? You're
100%. I feel fine. I'm going to get into why my voice sounds this way as we talk about our topic tonight. I think there's an interesting tie-in between those subjects. So maybe we'll just jump right in and skip the small talk and go straight into the show.
That sounds great.
All right. Well, why don't we bring out our guest? We're so excited to have one of our favorite people with us. She has been a guest on Fast Forward Radio a couple or three times in the past. She was with us for both installments of The World Transformed. She's Sonia Arison. She's an author and policy analyst who studied the impact of new technologies on society for more than a decade. She's a senior fellow at the California-based Pacific Research Institute, and she's author of two previous books, Western Visions and Digital Dialogue, as well as numerous PRI studies on technology issues. She's a frequent media contributor and guest, and her work has appeared in many publications, including CBS columnist for Tech News. Her current book is called 100 Plus, and she's here to talk with us about it. Sonia, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, we're thrilled to have you, and we were talking a little bit before the show started. Why don't you give us a quick recap on how it's going? You've been promoting your book pretty hard now for, what, about 2 months, and how's it being received?
2.5 months, in fact, almost 3 months.
Oh, okay.
I've been doing a lot of travel and a lot of interviews, 2 to 3, well, actually 3 to 4 a day, except for Sundays. But it's going really well. I'm getting great feedback on the book. I actually was expecting, you know, maybe a little bit of negative feedback, but pretty much so far it's been really positive. So I'm really happy about that.
Well, that's terrific. Yeah, I was thinking one of the things we'd be able to do was tell you, you know, you're back among friends on Fast Forward Radio, but it sounds like these ideas have been fairly well received just about everywhere.
Yeah, you know, it's not always. I've done a number of radio interviews, and in the beginning, there's always sort of this tentative nature of, well, are we going to really like this topic? And then they start asking me questions, and they're sort of negative in the beginning, but then after they talk to me for a while, they come around, because ultimately, you know, the book is about how science and technology will allow us to live longer and healthier lives. And, you know, who doesn't want to be healthy is what it really comes down to.
Yeah. Although it does seem there is kind of a knee-jerk assumption that for some reason people are supposed to be opposed to this. That it's almost like without thinking about it, if they haven't thought about it, they think they're against it. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and there's a reason for that. I discuss that in the first chapter of the book, and that's because so much of our literature and so much of our culture is written to make us feel better about the idea that we're going to die. You know, you look at things like Gulliver's Travels, where there were the Strudelbergs who, you know, that were immortal, but they had terrible, terrible lives. Mm-hmm. And Greek mythology, where you know, humans. If you look at the tale of Eos and her human lover who Zeus allowed to live forever, but she forgot to ask for youth, so he aged and had this terrible life because he was alive for a really long time and old and decrepit, and and eventually couldn't even talk. And so there's all these stories in our culture about why, you know, even if we could live longer, we wouldn't want to. And you know, you think about it, and I think the reason why all those stories have been created is because we've never had the opportunity to live radically longer and healthier lives before. And since we haven't had the opportunity, we've come up with all these devices to make ourselves feel better about it. It's okay. We wouldn't want it anyway, right?
Right. A little bit of the old sour grapes principle at work there. And I remember in the book, in particular, you point out the picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde.
That's right. Yes. Another sort of dystopian story about what would happen if, you know, this one guy managed to become immortal, you know, for as long as he wanted, his painting would age instead of him. And so he stayed young for a very, very long period of time. But in Wilde's story, this didn't make him a better person. This actually made him immoral as well as immortal. And he just wasted his life and sort of at the end sort of just became crazy and wasn't happy and got so angry that he destroyed the painting. But when he did that, he destroyed himself. And so there's a number of dystopian stories out there. And, you know, in fact, I just saw one last night. I'm reviewing In Time, the new Justin Timberlake movie. It comes out on Friday, so I got a press pass to see that. And it's another dystopian movie about, you know, if the premise of that story is everybody in society stops aging at age 25, but then you only get a free year after that, and then you have to work for more time. And if you don't earn enough time, you die, right? And so then there's all these wealthy people who get to have immortal lives, and these poor people live day to day and might not make it. And that's the dystopian world that's painted in Time. And I think it's actually time to let go of those dystopian visions, because we've reached a point in history now where we actually do have a chance, a real chance, this is not science fiction, of living longer and healthier lives. And so it's time to write some stories that are not utopian, but more realistic.
And I always look for this in I always hope to see it in science fiction. You know, you don't expect necessarily to see it in fantasy, but there's so much dystopian science fiction. I get very disappointed when my oldest child is a huge Doctor Who fan, and so she makes me watch Doctor Who. And actually, I enjoy it quite a bit. But one of the tropes I've noticed that recurs, one of the storylines that seems to recur, is that somebody wants to live forever, that somebody wants to extend their life. And you would think that would be something that the show would at least be neutral towards, seeing as the Doctor himself, that character, gets to live forever. But no, every time that storyline comes up, it's always about this person is greedy, it's evil, he's trying to go beyond what our planned natural life is, and therefore there's got to be terrible. You know, it's the same kind of cycle of a story that as you see in all those examples that you just mentioned. So it seems that these tropes, and that idea that you mentioned in the book, that it's our fault somehow, right? That there's something wrong with us that makes us age anyway. It seems to be stuck in really deep. I'm hoping that there's going to be a new tropes in fiction, right? That maybe we can start getting some stories where some of these more transhumanist ideas get a fair shake, or maybe we see some of the advantages of some of these kinds of ideas.
Right, and it's not like you couldn't write an exciting movie based on the idea of living a longer, healthier life, or even an immortal life. I mean, you could still have action. You could still have people trying to take that away.
Right.
But it's just too often the storyline is that the evil people are the ones that get to live long and the good people are the ones who get to die. And it really should be flipped around so that, you know, everybody should has the opportunity to live a really long time or even be immortal. And the evil people are trying to take away, because that's, in reality, that's kind of where we're going right
that's
now.
That's closer to where we are, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, the movie Bicentennial Man, you start with an immortal robot who wants to be more and more human and tries to be declared a human. And, of course, It's only at the moment of death that he's embraced by the human community and declared to be a human. I'm like, come on, I love the movie. And then you do this, you know, you throw that out at the last, you know, like, you know, without death, we can't be human. Forgive me. I just don't buy that. You know,
that's right. It's this argument that the place that we're living now is the place where we should be forever, right? Like, we shouldn't go past, you know, life expectancy today is around 80 years. Therefore, 80 years must be the natural life expectancy. But that's sort of, it's a status quo argument. But it doesn't make any sense, because life expectancy in 1850 was 43. Life expectancy in the Cro-Magnon era was 18 years. Were those natural? Maybe now that we're living, you know, if you go back and you say, okay, well, now we've got a 80-year life expectancy, that's unnatural from the point of view of somebody who lived in 1850. So, you know, the world must be coming to an end. Under that logic. I mean, the logic doesn't make sense.
Yeah, what's wrong with us that we're so horrible and greedy and that we want to live to be 80, right, instead of dying in our, what, like 30s, right, or whatever it would have been.
Around the time of the European Renaissance, it was around 30.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's some ideas I want to talk with you about that occur in the book. First off, there is reference to a court case that I think might be being decided now, or that might be being argued now. That's referenced, and this is really interesting, and it goes to one of the most powerful potential treatments for aging or life extending treatments, and that is around I think it was genes or stem cells, but there was this
stem cells.
Stem cells. So this argument that stem cells are not a drug, and therefore they wouldn't be subject to FDA regulation. Therefore, some very promising therapies might make it into the hands of people who could benefit from them faster, because the whole FDA cycle of approvals isn't something that those would have to go through. Can you give us an update on that? What's the status of that?
You know, they've been actually fairly quiet. So the story is a Colorado clinic that was taking that was helping mostly people who were having knee problems, taking people's own stem cells, taking them out, making some tweaks in the lab, and then reinjecting them back in, and having some real success in treating problems with cartilage and other knee issues. And I interviewed Jarvis Green, who's a football player, who lost his job because his knees got so bad. He told me he couldn't even walk from the car to the house. It was really literally that bad. And so he got fired, of course. You can't be a football player like that. And he tried everything. Then he went to this clinic, and they did the procedure where they took out his stem cells, did some tweaks, and put them back in. And now he said, you know, he can walk, he can run, and he's got a new position with another football team. And so it really was a huge success story. And he's, of course, not the only one. But that clinic has had trouble because the FDA is looking at them and saying, look, stem cells have not been approved for therapeutic use in the United States. And furthermore, this may be a drug. And the clinic, of course, is arguing that this is not a drug. It can't be a drug because it's the person's own stem cells. And how would you even do, like, the way that the FDA does tests is they have these large trials. But you can't have a large trial because every person's stem cell is different, so every treatment would be different. Everyone is unique. So you can't really have a large trial of this kind of thing. And so it went to court, and I know they were planning on taking it all the way to the Supreme Court. I tried to follow up with them about a month ago, and they told me that they couldn't say anything, which I think probably means they're in some sort of negotiations. So that's all I know at this point. But it hasn't been completely resolved as far as I know.
Oh, okay. Well, to me, this sounds like something that could just be critical to how soon or how long it will be before we actually see some of those kinds of treatments. And to me, it seems like the relevant precedent. And Stephen, you're the lawyer on the program, so you can tell me if I'm completely out of touch here. But it seems to me the precedent might be something along the lines of abortion. The you know, there's this right to privacy that that gives us control over our own bodies under law. And you know, what could be more fundamental than like using your body to heal itself, right? It's like you're taking one part of your body and using it to correct another part of your body. It seems like I mean I'm not a lawyer, but it seems like that principle ought to extend to things beyond the one procedure that it currently does.
I completely agree, Phil. But then I would just have to say the reality is that the FDA won't allow for example someone who's terminally ill just to take a long shot and try some wild new therapy because I think that they all, if somebody's terminal, and they want to experiment, allow them to experiment, and that's kind of along the same lines, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And the interesting thing is I think most people would agree with that. So yep. The question is how is it that most people would agree with that, but that's not the policy? It's really quite interesting.
Yeah.
That's the kind of question. Once you start down that road, you see a lot of things that most people would agree with that aren't the policy, right? It seems like we.
True enough.
Interesting dynamics of democracy. How we end up with rules that haven't caught up with where we are, and you kind of get into that towards the end of the book. One of the things that I found really interesting was this discussion about how the fight against aging, the fight to extend healthy lifespan, is how it's catching on as a meme, how it is become something that the cool kids are going after, and it could be that our more traditional institutions are just going to have to do some catching up with where society might be trending, that we might be making up our minds about these things a little bit quicker than our institutions are able to adjust. And I know you talk about that in the book, but what could you comment on that a little bit? What do you think are the major institutions within society that are maybe the least prepared to deal with these kinds of changes?
Right. Well, I think that – let me just go back a little bit first and say that I think the big thing that's changed – is that we now know that aging is plastic. So just like we didn't think the brain was plastic, and then we found out later that it is, and you can still learn things when you're older, and the brain does adapt. We used to think that aging was set in stone, that there was, life expectancy might be growing, but at some point we are going to hit a limit, and there is a ceiling, and we can't live beyond a certain age. In essence, that we couldn't slow down aging. And we've now learned that that's not true, because scientists have been able to slow down aging in the lab. Cynthia Kenyon at UCSF has managed to tweak a couple of genes in worms, and by doing that has extended their youthful lifespan 6 times, which is pretty fantastic. And so not only do they live 6 times longer than they would have normally lived, but they stay younger longer, and that's because she slowed down aging, and she's not the only one to have done this. And since she's done it, and a number of other researchers across the country, and in fact across the world, have managed to replicate those experiments, that community now knows that aging is plastic, and that changes things. I mean, it changes all sorts of the way that we look at how do we solve problems like Alzheimer's and cancer. And, I mean, one way is to just try to fix the damage, and there's people who are working on that. Or one way is to try to find better cures to just eradicate it when it happens. But another way is to just slow down aging so that you don't get it for a much longer period of time. And it would be nice to see more people. I mean, it's a very exciting field, and legitimate scientists are actually working on it now. Before, if you mentioned anything about slowing down aging or anti-aging, and that sounded like snake oil. It was, because we didn't know. We didn't have the knowledge. We didn't have the data. We didn't have the experiments. But now it's not science fiction. Now we know it's reality, that it can be done. And that's changing things. The scientific community moves slowly. Funding agencies move even slower. And government moves slowly as well. And one of the problems I point out in the book is that the way that government regulatory agencies are set up, they're set up to approve drugs and therapies based on specific diseases. And aging is not a disease, according to them. So you get into the problem of, okay, so one of these amazing scientists comes up with a way to slow down aging and make people healthier for longer periods of time. There's no way to even get that approved because it doesn't fit under any of the categories in the FDA. So we have this issue of there could be a significant breakthrough on the horizon, but there would be no way to do anything with it. And so this is a serious case of government really lagging behind the reality of scientific discovery.
Sonia, do you think that we'll have a president in some near future time where he stands up and says, "We choose to conquer aging not because it's easy, but because it's hard," and really gets behind it? Or do you think you're going to see just a series of mavericks making discoveries until finally there's just we have it, and there hasn't been any big push from any central government?
I think at some point we will see our political leaders recognize this. And the reason for that is that it is reality, and it's pretty hard to fight reality. It just takes a long time for facts to get from the lab all the way over to D.C. And so, I'm hoping to actually go there and do some talks I've been invited to speak with some Congress people about my book. And, I think – if I go out there and talk and other people and, scientists show up, and, of course, because they want to try to get funding for this type of research, I mean, eventually the facts will reach D.C. The problem is that we don't want it to take too long because policymakers do affect our life, and they affect funding, and they affect all sorts of things. And so it'd be better if we could speed up that process of getting policy folks to realize the reality of the scientific community.
Yeah, I would love for my kids to benefit from this, but I would love also to benefit from it myself. So, there is an issue of time for a lot of
your kids would love it for you to benefit from it too, Stephen. I mean,
they're rather fond of me. Yeah, they come.
Yeah.
So
you know what's interesting about that is that there's huge benefit for government to be behind this. And just from a public policy standpoint, to favor whatever form that takes, whether it's Stephen, you were kind of alluding to the Apollo program there, whether it's some big government program that pushes towards development of this, or whether it's the government just recognizing it and trying to get out of the way so that it can allow it to happen, whatever the right stance is, but for the government to understand that this is in government's best interest, because one of the huge challenges that we face is this issue of the graying of the population and the tremendous medical expenses that are incurred in the final year of a person's life. And you think even if these treatments that we're talking about didn't actually extend the length of life, which is for whatever reason the piece that people most object to, the part about just staying healthy, right? If people could just be healthy until they die, rather than going through this, this horrible, degrading, appalling, degeneration that is so bad for them and so bad for the people around them, and such a drain, right, on the resources of society. It would be tremendously beneficial for society to turn that corner. Do you think there's any chance of government beginning to recognize that? People in government beginning to recognize ultimately financial benefits?
Yeah, I think they will see it at some point. I mean, as you point out, this is a way to solve not only Social Security, but also the healthcare crisis. You can solve two problems with one stone, right?
Right.
Or kill two birds with one stone, I guess that's the thing.
make two birds young and healthy.
Which would balance the budget, which is at the same time, which is a third bird that just kind of falls in the line because of it. Incredible what it would do.
Right. Yeah. And so it's just getting them to understand the potential. And, there's some people within the government who get it. I point out in the book that one of the reasons why tissue engineering has advanced so far is because the Department of Defense is spending a lot of money funding regenerative medicine. And the reason that they're doing it, of course, is not to solve the healthcare crisis or Social Security. They're doing it because They want to grow brand new arms and legs and organs and hearts and lungs and muscle for soldiers who come back injured from the war. And they're making really great progress.
Well, you know, the ARPANET became the internet, so by doing what they're doing for selfish reasons may pay off for the rest of us eventually, huh?
But so. It will. It already is.
Yeah.
Amazing stuff. Well, you know, one of the things that two things I want to talk about that come up later in the book are the impact that a much longer lifespan, including the idea of people living healthier much longer, will impact families and how it will impact the workforce. So let's take those in that order. Sonia, can you say a little something about first off, let me back up a little bit and say, what's the age, the lifespan that you're talking about in the book, and how did you settle on that one?
Right. Yes. I look at a rough doubling of health expectancy, and I like to say health expectancy instead of life expectancy because it's how long we'll be alive. We'll extend how long we're alive but healthy, right?
Right.
And so I take the premise that we will be able to extend health expectancy to 150 years, which is a rough doubling of where we are now. And the reason I do that, I mean, potentially you could say, okay, well, we could go even beyond that. Why stop at 150? But I wanted to do that because it was repeating an experiment, right? Because life expectancy was 43 in 1850, and we're at around 80 now. So we've already had a rough doubling once. And that made it easier for me to go back and look and say, okay, well, what happened the last time we roughly doubled life expectancy? How did the world change? How did longevity affect everything, our social life, our economic life, our cultural life? And then I dug into the research, and it turns out I'm not the first person to ask these questions. In fact, a number of scholars have worked on this, particularly in economics, but also in sociology and other areas. And so when I looked at the family, you know, I found what you would probably expect is that the age at first marriage went up significantly. The age at for first-time mothers has been going up steadily. Some people say that right now we're in the era of the 40-year-old mom. That's the group that's growing the quickest right now, at least in the developed world.
Right.
And, you know, if you take those trends, and those are not the only trends, by the way, but if you take those trends and extrapolate and say, okay, well, let's do it again, at some point we might be in the era of the 70-year-old mom. And, you know, fertility specialists or OB, you know, GYNs might look at that and go, oh, wow, well, you know, we couldn't do that today because, you know, we know that a 70-year-old today can have a child if she borrows someone else's eggs, right? The uterus continues to work. It's the eggs that go bad, and eggs, a woman's eggs go bad around, you know, starting at 40, and by 50, they're pretty much gone for everyone. And so then the question is there a way to extend that, to save the eggs, recreate the eggs? And it turns out that the answer is yes. And in lab animals, what they've been able to do is take very small slivers of ovarian tissue. And this ovarian tissue has lots of millions of miniature eggs in it. And that's much easier to freeze. Right now, some clinics are trying to freeze eggs, but the problem with that is the eggs have a really high water content. And you know what happens when you freeze water, it breaks and the cellular structure doesn't hold. And so that actually hasn't been a good way to preserve fertility. But if you can take the eggs when they're very small and freeze them, they have much less water in them. And so it's possible to freeze them well. And so then the question was, well, how do we get them from immature to mature so that they can actually be fertilized? And that was the hurdle point. That was what researchers were struggling with for a long time. And recently they've been able to break through that and figure out how to develop the egg from something that's really immature to something that's able to be fertilized. And, you know, you could say that's growing the egg. It's not quite growing the egg because it was already there, but it's developing it. And that's been done in lab animals. A successful pregnancy came out of that. And they're waiting to try it on humans. Of course, they have to wait for somebody to volunteer, but I'm sure that won't be long.
And that's an astounding thought. But if they're able to make that work, then 70 isn't even the ceiling, right? It could, if you're talking about a 150-year lifespan, you could have a mother at age 120, 130, maybe even.
Sure.
As you were talking about how things changed from the 19th century to today, I suddenly had this thought. What if, Sonia, you had lived then, right? What if in the 1850s you had written a book called 80 Plus, right? Predicting the strange world of the 21st century when people lived this long. And I was just thinking about the wacky predictions you would have made, right? That people would wait until their 20s or maybe even their 30s to get married, that people might make it to adulthood and still know their grandparents, that people might have met their great-grandparents. All these things that would have sounded actually pretty shocking to people living at that time, which we take as just completely mundane. It's no big deal at all that people, get married in their 20s and 30s today.
And you can even go beyond that, because if you were living back then, you'd say, there's things that weren't even invented back then, right? Like central heating, for instance. And so you were warming yourself with fire and cool, and everything was so polluted. And you can imagine looking at it and going, oh, my God, really? 40 more years of, like, adding 40 years of this? We'd be breathing smoke for that much longer, and we'll all have lung disease. And these are the things you'd be complaining about. But what you have to remember is that technology advances on every level. And things will probably be better in the future. The things that bother you now are probably not going to be bothering you in the future. It might be something different, but we'll deal with that then.
Yeah, well, you can rest assured something will be bothering you, right?
Of course.
There's not going to be a problem-free era, but you're right. When we're living to be 150 years old or even older, it will not be a life fraught with the problems we have today. It will be life that is fraught with problems that they have in that future time, which to us, if we could see them, we'd go, oh, that doesn't sound that bad.
Right.
Those guys, they don't have it nearly so bad. So what is the big...
The family space shuttle is, on the blink. That's the problem.
Exactly. That's right. Something like that. So what are the big kinds of changes that we could expect to see inside families that would map to things like people marrying? If you live to be 150, people might get married in their 80s or 90s, right? People
That's
might
right.
start
First
college.
First-time marriage could be in their
50s.
80s.
Yeah.
And you could see huge age divides, right? Because many people might wait, it doesn't mean everyone will. And you could imagine a 20-year-old marrying a 120-year-old, and you'd have really huge age differences like that. Now, I actually make the argument in the book that I don't think that, even though that would be a possibility, I don't think it would be common. And that's because age tends to be one of those things that we look for commonalities with people, and we tend to get along better with people who are in our age cohort. Now, that's not always the case, and we probably would see some big age divides, but I don't think it would be super common. You'd also see big age gaps potentially between siblings. I mean, you can imagine a couple having, maybe they have their first child at 25. And then they wait and they have a career and they do a bunch of different things, and then when they're 80 they decide, you know what, it'd be great to have another baby, and so that's like a really huge gap between that sibling would be grown up already, could have been their parent, right?
Grandparent, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so what kind of a relationship would those two siblings have? I mean, it would be a much different relationship than siblings today have.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And, you think about it, and I posit in the book that, maybe it would be more like an uncle relationship, an uncle-aunt kind of thing.
I can imagine a 70-year-old saying, I just had an aunt born today,
Yeah.
Right.
That kind of stuff could be going on.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, let's shift it over and talk about the world of work. This idea of an older workforce is really interesting to me. I mean, one of the ideas, spinning it back to my scenario just a minute ago, even if we didn't make people live any longer, if they could just stay vital right up until the end, you would have the situation where many more people who go into this thing called retirement, which is this like long limbo that, you know, self-imposed limbo that that we put people into, often because they, you know, ultimately their health isn't going to support being terribly active into those later years anyway. But I think for the most part that idea would go away, or would be significantly postponed if people, you know, if someone's healthy up until age 85 and they feel roughly the same way someone feels in their 30s or 40s today, it just seems very likely to me that those people would continue working. So how's the workforce different when you've got those much more experienced people not kind of fading out so quickly, kind of sticking around? How does that change the workforce?
Right. Well, I think we'd definitely be more productive because you'd have, you know, health equals wealth. People who are healthy produce things. But the workforce definitely would be different, as you point out. I mean, you could even imagine a healthy 100-year-old working with someone who's 20. I mean, there would be definitely intergenerational issues to overcome. I mean, we're seeing a little bit of that today with boomers and people who are just entering the workforce, Generation Y, and the generation after them. And so, you know, that's something that we will have to deal with in the future. That may be one of our problems that today we kind of laugh about.
Well, it's really interesting to me because just in context, I'm in Las Vegas this week. I'm at a conference related to my day job, and I got to thinking that it's been almost exactly 25 years ago that I ever went to my first conference, doing actually a lot of the same stuff that I do now. I mean, you know, hopefully I get paid a little better these days, but basically I've done a lot of the same activities over the years, and I feel, you know, I'm thinking back over it, and I'm like, okay, so 25 years ago, I went to my first ever conference. It was in Las Vegas. Here I am 25 years later doing the same kinds of things. You know, what's the difference? Well, I feel like I'm much better at it. I feel like I immediately know that certain things are going to work, certain things aren't going to work. There's a whole instinct around planning it out, and just I feel like I've got this wealth of experience that I can bring to it. But I was talking as I mentioned to Stephen before we brought you out. You know, why am I so hoarse? Well, we were at after doing software demos for 12 hours yesterday, we went to a nightclub out on the Las Vegas Strip, and I'm, you know, trying to scream to make myself heard over the music, and now I'm completely hoarse. And the thing that occurred to me is like, well, here's the other difference, right? Because I was actually sharing a table with this couple, and they were probably 24, 25 years old, so probably right around the same age I was the first time I came to Las Vegas and did one of these conferences, and they're just in their element. They're just having a blast, and I'm like trying to scream a conversation with them, and I'm seeing how much they're enjoying themselves, and I'm standing there thinking, my feet are killing me. My feet hurt so bad, right? I so wish I could go back to my room and lie down right now because my feet hurt so bad, right? And you know, I'm thinking that's the difference right there. Okay, so I've got I've got this ability to deliver the job so much better, but my body isn't where it was right the first time I came, because when I was first there, I would have been with them, you know, on the running up and down the strip, hitting different places, and come back to the room and crash at 4 a.m. and then back up and work the booth again in a few hours. And what I got to thinking was, well, one of the things we say about older, or one of the expectations I maybe stereotypically we would have about older folks in the workforce is that, and in fact, I know you mentioned in the book that they're more patient. I think there would also be an expectation that they're more conservative. And I wonder, do we become more conservative as we age because that's a natural part of aging, or is it because our bodies themselves are actually slowing us down at that point?
Right, that's a good question. And I dug into the psychological research on that. And from what I could tell, personalities actually stay pretty stable over time. And to the extent that people might become more conservative, maybe it's because they've realized facts about the world that they didn't realize before. You know, you have the typical really idealistic youth who then discovers truths about the world and then becomes more conservative. But that's not becoming more conservative because they're getting old. It's because they've discovered certain truths.
Right.
But I think in this instance,
I don't mean conservative like politically conservative. I don't mean to the right necessarily, but I mean like more cautious, right?
Right.
You know what I mean? Less entrepreneurial, that sort of thing in the business.
It turns out that risk-taking actually stays really stable over lifetime, and it's more of a personality trait than it is something that changes with learning new facts. And so, you know, you think there's people who are young who are really risk-averse, and there's people who are old who still take lots of risks. I mean, if I think
–
this is anecdotal, of course, and this wasn't in my book, but if I think about my father, who's an entrepreneur – and, you know, he's 72, and he just started 3 new companies in the last couple of years.
Wow.
He's still taking a ton of risk, and that's because that's who he is. I mean, all his life he's taken big gambles and lost and then won and then lost and then won, and, you know, and that's just his personality. I think that's the case for most people, as long as you're healthy. The problem comes in is if you're that personality type and then you get sick. Well, then you can't take any risks because you're at home in bed. You can't do anything. And that's when it all starts to break down.
Yeah, absolutely.
So ultimately, if we can keep people healthy, back to your earlier point, it sounds like just pretty much a win-win. It's a huge upside for the workforce. Is there a downside in that these people never going away prevents there from being opportunity for the young people who want to come into the workforce?
I think that's certainly a worry, it's a worry based on the idea of a zero-sum world, that if someone gets something, then somebody else loses. And in reality, our world is not a zero-sum world. If somebody's in a great position, then and you can't move up the ladder in that company, you go to another company. Oh, or you start your own company, right? There's different ways that the economy can grow. And so – you know, I think it'll be possible that there will be some tension over, you know, young people seeing these powerful business executives who just aren't going away and probably feel resentment over that. But at the same time, that's motivation for them to get out and start new things or perform better so that they get promoted. I mean, you can really imagine a day, actually, when an older person just gets fired because they're resting on their laurels, they're not performing, and they do get replaced by someone younger, even though the older person is healthy. And so it's going to be motivation for everybody to stay on top of their game. And, you know, there's one other thing I wanted to mention, actually, which didn't come up yet, and that's the idea of innovation being a late peak field. That's something that I discovered when I was doing my research that I didn't know, because I live in Silicon Valley, and there's a lot of stories here about, oh, new companies being started by people in their 20s, right? Like Google, Larry and Sergey, and Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, Apple, they were really young. And so we see these big success stories and we think, oh, well, new cool ideas are always started by young people. But in fact, that's not the case. The research actually shows that innovation is a late peak field. People tend to be their most innovative around 40. It peaks at 40.
Oh, that's interesting.
But then health starts to decline around 50. So you only have that 10-year – if it peaks at 40, I mean, maybe it peaks at 40 because then people start to lose their health, right? I mean, what if their health was extended even further? Maybe that peak would stay up. Maybe people would be innovative for much longer.
People start having their innovative peak at 65, 70, you know, right in the age range that currently we start discounting people from even having a role in the workforce by and large, right? That might be when they could become the most valuable.
Right, and the idea, Stephen, I mean, they've been around, they've seen a lot of things, and they can connect the dots where other people can't connect the dots because they've seen enough that they can do that.
There is no substitute for experience. I mean, it's just having done it a few times, anything in any walk of life, it makes all the difference. Stephen, I was about to say, I feel like I'm jumping on you, and I think you probably have some questions you want to ask as well. I've kind of been dominating the conversation here. Go ahead if you have something.
Oh, no problem. I promise. I'll jump right in when I need to. But let me ask you, Sonia. The subtitle of the book mentions faith, you know, how the coming age of longevity will change everything from careers and relationships to family and faith. It, you know, it seems to me that all religions have, you know, pretty much two big problems that they deal with. That's morality and death. And how do you see indefinite lifespans impacting religion?
Right. You know, the religion chapter was the most interesting chapter for me to write. And, in fact, it took me the longest because as I was collecting data, I didn't believe it. I did not believe the data I was collecting because when I looked back, and as we've roughly doubled our life expectancy in the past, we did not become less religious.
Hmm.
And I couldn't believe that. And so I was looking through all the theories. And, you know, back in the 70s, there were a number of sociologists who believed that as we became more modern and more scientific, we'd become less religious. And that theory kind of seems to make intuitive sense. But they've since changed their tune, and most sociologists don't believe that anymore. And the world has stayed consistently religious. 90% of the world is religious, and it stayed consistently that way, except during the 1970s, when the communists were in control, it dipped down because they outlawed religion, and then it popped back up after they lost power, which is
interesting. I suspect it was underground at that time. I suspect it stayed the same. It was just in secret.
Right, the reporting was just different.
Yeah.
And so the question is why? How come as we learn more and more about science, we don't become less religious? And I think the answer, I mean, there's a couple of different explanations. One explanation is, you know, we're just wired for religion. We're wired to be spiritual. That's an okay explanation. There's another explanation, though, and that is, as you pointed out earlier, that religion is not just about the afterlife. It's not just about what happens after death. It's also about purpose. Religion also speaks to not only morality, as you mentioned, but also, you know, what is the purpose of life? Why are we here? What are we supposed to be doing with our life? And you could actually make the argument that as we live longer and healthier, we'll actually need more guidance on how to live, not less. And so what I say in the book is that religion is not going to go away. It's clearly not going to go away. But I think it will evolve. And I think that the religions that do well in the future will be the ones who help people live better lives rather than the ones that focus on the afterlife.
Okay, yeah. All right.
It seems to be trending that way even now, that there's probably an awful lot of an awful lot of focus. You look at these, for example, these big evangelical churches, which are doing really well. There have been these movements within them, things like the purpose-driven life, and you know, this kind of whole lifestyle that they're supporting over and above just a sort of not that the focus on the afterlife has completely gone away, but they do seem to be addressing a lot more aspects of life beyond just that. I've got one other thing I wanted to get to before we. I know we're gonna have to start wrapping up here in just a couple of minutes before we get to the final question. But this is kind of a non sequitur. This is not something covered in the book. Just curious how you would answer this question, Sonia. How long do you expect to live?
Well. I hate to answer that question.
Okay.
Because you don't want to be wrong, do you?
Well, no, you don't. Well, I don't mind being wrong if I say like 80 and it's, you know, 200. That's okay. But
That's right. Yeah. I mean, today I can expect 80. But, you know, there are breakthroughs that have been created in the lab. The question is how long will it take to go from lab to mass market to something that I can actually use. You know, recently Dr. Carl June at the University of Pennsylvania announced that he managed to cure leukemia by using gene therapy. He took out some immune system cells from some patients who had terminal leukemia, tweaked them so that their immune system cells would recognize cancer as a virus and fight it like it would a cold, put them back into the patient's body. The patient's got these huge fevers and night sweats, and just like you would have if you had a big infection. and their bodies completely fought, for two of the patients, completely fought off the cancer, and they're cancer-free. And that is just amazing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, imagine if you could do that for all different types of cancer. But how long will it take for him to get that work, that amazing work from that to, you know, teaching doctors all over the country to use it and how to do it and, you know, and going through testing? And it takes a long time.
Right.
So I don't know. I hope I'm not in the last generation before these big technologies roll out. I hope I make it. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book, because we really do need for these things to be developed quicker, not at the pace that they're going, if we're gonna benefit in time.
Well, the tagline of the Ray Kurzweil and Terry Grossman book from a couple of years ago was live long enough to live forever, right? And the idea being, if you can, and we say live to see it at the Spec, it's the same kind of idea. If you can make it to the point where you can benefit from the things that are coming, right? You don't want to fall short of those. So this is actually a two-part question, because the second part of the question was, and maybe this one should have come first, but how long would you like to live? How long would you like your life expectancy to be?
I would like to live as long as possible. I can't imagine.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if some people say, oh, well, wouldn't you get bored, or, you know, wouldn't, you know, whatever, and it's, well, I don't think so. And if I do, at that point, I'll deal with that problem, right? I mean, I don't want the choice taken away from me before I get there.
Right.
That's right.
Well, I've heard Eliezer Yudkowsky answers this question as, I really like this answer. He says, I don't know what the, you know, if you stretch it all the way to the end, I don't know that answer, but I know I want to live one more day.
Mm-hmm.
And tomorrow I'll probably want to live one more day. Right.
And then the next day you'll want one more day. And so
yeah, exactly. I don't see that. I don't see that changing. And it seems like it's just such a ultimately natural desire that if you affirm life and you think your life is a good thing, that you look forward to more of it, and it's a very positive thing that we're talking about here, and it's ultimately a very positive set of developments for us as, you know, as a society, for us as individuals, and for us as a species. That we're heading in this direction, and I really picked up on a sense of that in the book, and I just wanted to say how much I enjoyed reading the book. I think it's a wonderful treatment of these issues, which are so important right now, and it's terrific to get the perspective from so many different dimensions. You go into how it's going to impact society. You talk about the different approaches that are being taken. You talk about the objections, and for anyone who hasn't had a chance to read the book yet, I can't recommend it. Can't recommend it highly enough.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I tried to cover everything that was relevant, which was very ambitious, but I think I managed to do it. And I made a point of writing the book in a way that it would be easy to read for my mother.
Target reader in mind.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, I've had fun with my kids with your book, Sonia. I mean, what I've done is, we would kind of play. Let's find the YouTube video, and we would, you know, I'd read out loud to them, and they would say, okay, that's got to be a YouTube video. You know, when you mentioned the 60 Minutes interview and things like that,
right.
You know, we'd go and we'd watch that together, and we'd talk about it. It's an excellent book. It's a great conversation starter. I'm with Phil. Can't recommend it highly enough. It's fantastic.
Thanks.
So, what's going to happen next? Is there going to be a movie made out of this? You're going to obviously continue talking this subject. Do you have another book planned? What's going on?
We'll see. You know, there is so much interest in this book from all sorts of places, and I actually have spoken with a few Hollywood people about it.
Outstanding. I think it'd be a great idea for a documentary.
I think it's time for there to be a story that's about reality and not dystopian, because there's just too many dystopian things out there that are really not based on fact, and more based on fantasy and culture as we've always known it before the ability to actually slow down aging and repair ourselves in better ways.
Absolutely. Well, listen, we wish you all the best. We hope that that you'll be back on the program with us somewhere down the road to report on what's happening next or what your next project will be. Sonia Arison, always a pleasure talking with you.
Great. Thanks, guys. Great talking with you as well.
Okay, Stephen, what's our music this evening?
Well, you know, Phil, I do my best to try to find stuff that I think is great music, and I don't always succeed. This one, I think, we'll all enjoy. It's called Broken Stereo by Sean Fournier.
Sean Fournier with Broken Stereo. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. And thanks to all of you for listening. A great chat going on this evening in the chat room. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio, those who are listening live and those who are listening via MP3. We'll be back again next week. Hope you'll be able to join us. And until next time, live to see it.
Why do you look so glum? Are you breaking behind the smile that I know you're faking? It is no surprise, I see it in your eyes, and they just don't lie. As if your life was a broken stereo, will I be music to your ears, and your fears would be drowned.
Cause I'm in your vicinity, but you do not consider me.
I'm in your vicinity, you do not consider me. Cause I'm in your vicinity, you do not consider me.